Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Tens of millions of Americans are struggling with opioid addiction or obesity, chronic disease, just a myriad of other physical, mental, and behavioral issues. Today's guest, Dr. Robert Lustig, is making the argument that in the last half century or so, America and most of the Western world, in fact, have become more and more unhappy, sick, and broke. Marketing, media, technology, he says they've all capitalized on subverting our brain physiology to their advantage in order to veer us away from the pursuit of happiness to the pursuit of pleasure. And Dr. Lustig argues those are two very different things. For corporations, that means that the pursuit of profit, with corporations profiting, means that happiness for us seems to be a bit more elusive nowadays. And certainly with the holidays upon us, the pursuit of happiness through gifts and food is really on overdrive. And for a lot of folks, it's a really happy celebratory time. But for many others, these holidays trigger anxiety, depression, and of course, a change in eating habits. So how do we reclaim our health and our happiness as individuals and as a society? Dr. Lustig joins me in studio to help answer that question. Dr. Robert Lustig is a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco, and he's professor emeritus at UCSF and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies. He's the acclaimed author of Fat Chance, The Bittersweet Truth About Sugar, and his latest book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains, is where we're going to start today. And it's that science part that we want to get to as quickly as possible, because it's pretty fascinating. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Lustig.
Thank you for having me, Renee. It's my pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Been looking forward to this. So let's talk about the science of what you claim is an absolute corporate takeover of our physiology.
Well, first you have to understand these two terms that we've sort of thrown out there, pleasure and happiness. Now, the question is, how are they the same? How are they different? They're both positive emotions. They're both things we strive for, but they are not the same. Corporate America has made them the same, but they are not the same. So let's define what the differences are. There are seven differences between pleasure and happiness. Number one, pleasure is short-lived, like an hour, like a good meal. Happiness is long-lived, days, years, sometimes a whole lifetime. Number two, pleasure is visceral. You feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal. You feel it above the neck. Three, pleasure is taking. Happiness is giving. Mm. Number four, pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Number five, pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. Six, the extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors. So substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors like shopping, video games, internet, social media, porn, all in the extreme lead to addiction. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And finally, number seven, the one that the book concentrates on, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. Now,
that's the science part of this
thing. That's the science part. Mm. So two different neurotransmitters, chemicals in the brain, two different sets of neurons they come from and interact with, two different receptor molecules, you know, that neurotransmitter binds to, two different modes of regulation. So like you say, like, who cares? Why do we care? So what? Well, we need to care, and here's why. Dopamine, the pleasure neurotransmitter, it's excitatory. It excites the next neuron. So when it's released from one neuron to the next, and this happens in an area of the brain called the reward center or the nucleus accumbens, it stimulates the next neuron, and that is the feeling of reward. that we all strive for. Now, neurons like to be stimulated. That's why they have the receptors in the first place. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron in the body will cause neuronal cell death. And we know that because of kids who have chronic seizure disorders and how it ends up causing significant developmental delay. And you can see the brain frying on MRI. So stimulating a neuron excessively is not good for it. So the postsynaptic neuron, the receiving neuron, has a plan B, an option, you know, to self-protective mechanism, if you will. What it does is it downregulates the receptor. So what does this mean in human terms? You get a hit. You get a rush. Receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush because there are fewer receptors. And then a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit until finally a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neuron actually does start to die, that's called addiction.
So, and this chain of events that you just described, that can happen whether you're indulging in a hit of cocaine, a hit on a cigarette, or if you just got a sale at TJ Maxx.
Absolutely.
And you're buying.
Or from eating those, you know, that whole bag of Chips Ahoy chocolate chip cookies.
Same thing. Same thing.
It's the exact same phenomenon through the same neurons and the same mechanism in the same area of the brain and gives you the same feeling of immediate reward.
And again, the difference between pleasure and happiness is one is long-lived, the other is short-lived.
Right. Now, serotonin, the happiness neurotransmitter, it's not excitatory, it's inhibitory. It actually puts the next neuron to rest. So it doesn't have to downregulate its own receptor because it's not going to fry the next neuron. So you can't overdose on too much happiness because the receptors stay there. But there's one thing that downregulates serotonin.
What's that?
Dopamine.
Okay.
So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. And throw a soupçon of stress on top of this, the hormone cortisol, and the disabling of the executive part of the brain above your eyes, you know, behind your forehead, called the prefrontal cortex, which is sort of the Jiminy Cricket of your brain, the part of your brain that keeps you from doing stupid things. Stress inactivates that and causes the release of this hormone cortisol, which ends up causing your dopamine to go into overdrive, downregulates the serotonin receptor, so you end up with more addiction and more depression too.
And the difference is between the prefrontal cortex, the front part of the executive part of the brain, mm-hmm. and what I guess you're saying, what I've heard is called the lizard part, that really elemental part of the brain that just wants what?
I want more. The lizard part of your brain is that nucleus accumbens. It's the limbic system. It's the part of your brain that says, I'm going to survive and I want more. And so the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain that controls that and puts that into equilibrium. But when that's not working, you go hog wild. And that's basically the, you know, a stepstone to addiction.
And I think you mentioned in element number five that no matter what it is you're doing in excess, it will invariably, it sounded like to me, inevitably lead to addiction. Is that right?
Well, let's put it this way. It has the capacity to lead to addiction. There are many things that will put you over the top. There are certain predisposing factors. There are some genetic factors. Let me give you an example. Let's take an easy one. Let's take alcohol. Okay. 40% of the U.S. population are teetotalers. Don't touch alcohol at all. 40% of the population are social drinkers. They can pick up a drink, put it down, not a problem. 20% of the U.S. population are hardcore alcohol abusers, alcoholics. And 10% are actually more than addicted but actually need rehab. So the bottom line is there are differences in propensity, there are differences in risk, and different people have different risk thresholds. Some things that make things the whole reward system worse are things like adverse childhood experiences. That degree of stress that occurs early on actually causes the brain to be altered in such a way as to make addiction much more likely later on in life. There are genetic differences. There's an allele of the dopamine receptor called the TAC1A allele. If you have that alteration in that receptor, you end up with 30 to 40% fewer receptors to start with, which means you need a whole lot more chocolate chip cookies to get any hit of pleasure. And so it is associated with obesity. So there are things that will modify or modulate your risk for addiction. But ultimately, anything that stimulates that reward center has a holic at the end of it, whether it's alcoholic or chocoholic or, you know, shopaholic or any other holic. That's the ultimate extreme manifestation of excessive and nonstop reward.
20%, one out of five.
Yeah.
That number is pretty high.
It's a big number. And worse yet, if you look at the secular trends in alcohol consumption over the last 10 years, it's been going up like crazy. An 83.7% increase in alcohol abuse amongst women. And do you know which age group?
What age group?
45 and over.
Any reason?
We're not, well, you tell me. Let's, in fact, this will lead us right into this whole concept of the corporate takeover of our bodies and brains. Why is it that people, women over 45, now think it's okay to drink and abuse alcohol? Maybe because it's 5 o'clock somewhere. You know where it's 5 o'clock? It's 5 o'clock at 10 o'clock on the East Coast every single morning, Monday through Friday. The Today Show Happy Hour on NBC, where Hoda and Kathy Lee sit around drinking and have given license to women to drink. And this is particularly pernicious because Hoda has breast cancer, and alcohol is a known promoter of breast cancer recurrence.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So there are additional stresses on women of a certain age, too.
Absolutely.
To look younger, to perform better, to have achieved certain things in life.
And who put those stresses there?
So here comes the corporate explanation part of your book, The Hacking Indeed. Of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. So talk about, I mean, do you think that they've actually gotten into the science of this thing, the chemical parts of our brains?
Oh, absolutely. They've all hired neuroscientists very specifically to exploit this.
Really?
Oh, and they're on record. They're on record as having said so. Tristan Harris was a former Google executive who's outed the company. He was on 60 Minutes in the PBS NewsHour and has left the company and started his own nonprofit called Time Well Spent to get people off social media. Sean Parker, one of the co-founders of Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, announced on the air that Facebook designed its product to be addictive. This is not by accident.
Yeah,
this is very well planned.
That's remarkable. Recently, like you said, Sean Parker, who is now the founder and chair of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, talked about his time at Facebook in an interview with Axios. And he said, and I quote, referring to what you just said, mm-hmm. anxiety is a huge problem now. Facebook is a social validation feedback loop. It is exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. He didn't say physiology, but human psychology. So
psychology is physiology when it comes right down to it. Every thought is the phosphorylation of a protein.
So are these technologies literally designed to get us hooked?
Well, indeed they are, and there are several books on this topic. One I quote in my book is Nir Eyal, who is an internet entrepreneur down in the valley, wrote a book in 2015 called Hooked, How to Create Habit-Forming Products. And there are four parts to this. The first is the trigger, which we might call the proverbial itch, if you will, like your email going off on your cell phone. The next thing is the action, which is the proverbial scratch, which has to be socially acceptable, something you can do in public, like checking your email, which currently today is still socially acceptable, or texting while walking, which is now not socially acceptable in Hawaii, which is very good. The third is what's known as variable reward, and this is where they get you. The reward can't be the same every time. So when you look at your email, some of them are good emails and some of them are bad emails. That's very variable, isn't it? Okay, like a slot machine in your pocket. And it's designed to be just that. Okay, like Groupon or Overstock. Okay, got to get it now. And what is it? And that keeps you coming back for more. And it is that variable reward. Do you use your GPS?
Not knowingly. Sometimes it just shows up.
Sometimes you do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, okay. But the thing is, do you constantly come back and check it, you know, minute after minute?
I don't.
No, because it's the same every time. You don't need to keep checking it, right? Okay. So GPS is a technology that's actually been helpful to most people. They don't get lost. Okay. It's saved on gas. It's saved on time, you know, on the roads. But it doesn't keep changing. You don't keep checking it, you know, out of want for it to change. So variable reward is sort of the key to this whole vicious cycle. And then the fourth is investment. The reason why you would plunk $1,000 down for the iPhone 10. Okay, that's the only part the company is interested in. So they've got this down to a science. And this is not just for technology. This is for smoking. This is for alcohol. This is for, you know, sugar. Anything that stimulates the reward system will basically put you into this overdrive. And then take stress and basically subvert the executive function part of your brain to allow that reward system to go hog wild, and you've got the makings of addiction.
Dr. Robert Lustig is here, pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco. His new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, the science behind the corporate takeover of our bodies and brains, is our guest. Maybe you've been kind of feeling a little blue over the holidays. How important is it for you to make that distinction between feeling happy and feeling pleasure? We're making that distinction today. And how do you decouple yourself from that barrage of ads and things that you are being encouraged to consume this time of the year? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. Dr. Lustig, what happens when, say, you're stressed out and you have a drink or you have a smoke and to try to relieve that stress? What's the chemical reaction?
So
there?
There's an area of your brain called the amygdala. Okay, it's about walnut-sized, and there's one on both sides of your in your temporal lobes. And this is the fear stress center. And it is hooked up to that prefrontal cortex, and it is also hooked up to the hippocampus, which is the memory center. And it's also hooked up to the hypothalamus, which is the hormone release center. And they all work in concert. And the amygdala and the hippocampus, the fear and the memory centers, are reciprocal. So when the fear center goes on, the memory center goes off, and vice versa. The goal is to keep your fear down and your memory working. Unfortunately, that's not what happens, because what stress does is, by activating that fear center, your memory center goes down, and so you're going to make the same mistake twice is what happens. And by releasing cortisol, you are basically changing your body's metabolism to burning protein and upping your blood sugar, which, you know, in the grand scheme can give you diabetes. It gives a phenomenon called insulin resistance and ultimately leads to a lot of the chronic metabolic diseases we know of today, like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, etc. And what you do is, by eating or by drinking, what you're doing is you are temporarily trying to tamp down that fear center. And it works temporarily, but it will be back. And when it's back, you will do it again and again and again until finally it won't work at all. And then you're addicted.
You know, we all remember those sessions before Congress where the tobacco industry, you know, just kind of stood there and flat-footed lied about the science behind the addiction of their products.
Absolutely.
But I imagine most of us are really stunned that that very same thing is at work in whether it's our technology or what we're eating. One of your colleagues, Dr. David Perlmutter, writes about your book. He says, our health, our resistance to disease, our ability to just function on a day-to-day basis have essentially been hijacked, all in the name of corporate profits. Dr. Lustig explores how industry has manipulated our most deep-seated survival instincts to motivate our food choices in a way that directly undermines our ability to just basically survive. But he goes on to say, but more importantly, in your book, The Hacking of the American Mind, you eloquently reveal how we can disengage from this influence and reestablish ourselves on a path to wellness.
Indeed.
I think those the whole idea that we're being manipulated this way is just shocking.
Well, you know, this concept's been around for a long time. I don't know, you may remember back in the 1960s and early 70s, they were talking about things like subliminal advertising, like in print media. You know, I remember the alcohol, you know, the drink, I forget which whiskey or scotch it was, being poured over the ice cubes, and you could see the letters S-E-X in the ice cubes, you know, stuff like that, you know, to kind of subliminally advertise. So, you know, the concept of trying to, you know, get you to buy a product has been around for a long time. What is new is, number one, the science. Number two, the fact that these two neurotransmitters, the serotonin and dopamine, are inexorably linked together. So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. That's new, and how stress ultimately impacts that. And the other thing is this idea that ideas can up your dopamine. The idea that zealotry can basically act as a dopamine agonist in your brain. And we know this from studies of religious fanatics. Sam Harris, who's written many books, he's known as one of the four horsemen of atheism. He is a neuroscientist, a real honest-to-goodness, card-carrying neuroscientist, a neuroimager. And what he did was he did a great study of religious zealotry. He took 15 devoutly religious people of different denominations, and he took 15 atheists who did not believe in God at all, and he stuck them in an fMRI scanner. And while they were in there, he would read them messages that would either support their religious view or be against their religious view. And it didn't matter which way he went, whether it was, you know, religious or non-religious. If you heard a statement that you corroborated, your dopamine pathway, the nucleus accumbens, lit up like a Christmas tree. And if you heard the opposite, it basically went down to zero. And it went both directions. So when the atheist heard something non-religious, their dopamine pathway went up. So this concept that you can basically get people to glom on to a specific message is not new. It's called marketing. The question is, what's the difference between marketing and propaganda?
It would explain a lot, wouldn't it? There seems to be...
Marketing is using information to espouse your point of view to get people's dopamine revved up. Propaganda is using disinformation to espouse your point of view to get people's dopamine revved up. What's the difference? The difference is the truth. So when you tell people what they want to hear, their dopamine goes hog wild. And whether it's true or not is irrelevant.
So even political consultants are using this data.
What do you mean, even? They're the ones who started it.
Yikes. This is Your Call. We're talking with Dr. Robert Lustig, one of my favorite interviews ever. He's a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco, and the acclaimed author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. We're going to take your calls as soon as we come back. Stay with us. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org, and there you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. And we love your show ideas as well. Give us a call at 866-798-8255. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly Friday Media Roundtable. Today, we're speaking with UCSF endocrinologist Dr. Robert Lustig, best known for his research into the addictive properties of sugar. But in his new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, Dr. Lustig widens his scope to look in general at how the food industry is fostering today's epidemics of addiction and depression. And we want to have you join our conversation, 866-798-8255. Are you finding the holidays stressful? How do you define happiness? And do you make a distinction between happiness and pleasure? Let's go to some of your calls. Thanks for holding on, Phil. It's you.
Thanks, Renee. I've got one comment and three brief questions, if that's okay. The comment is just to recommend that people view Dr. Lustig's YouTube presentation, The Bitter Truth. That's where I first learned of his work, and it's brilliant. I think it was intended for a UCSF audience. It goes into great detail on the chemistry and the metabolism of sugars and how close it is to the damage it does versus, let's say, for example, alcohol. So I found it enormously informative.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions?
Then the questions, my questions are, the first is, in The Bitter Truth, Doctor, you talked about those Harvard researchers, if I recall correctly, who got industry funding, and I don't know if it was in the 40s, the 50s, or the 60s, to basically absolve sugar of any dark connections. That they gave it a clean bill of health.
Right. So what happened was, in 1965, the Sugar Association paid two Harvard School of Public Health scientists, Fred Stair, the chairman of the Department of Nutrition, and his assistant, Mark Hegstead, who became the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, $6,500, which in today's terms would be $50,000, to produce two review articles for the New England Journal of Medicine about heart disease. And what they did was they exonerated sugar as being a contributor and fingered saturated fat as the bad guy. And that started our entire low-fat pandemic. And as you'll note, as the fat came out of our food, we became more obese and more diabetic and more hypertensive and all the chronic metabolic diseases that we know of today, known as metabolic syndrome. And we now have the reason and the data for why that has occurred, because of the unique metabolism of the molecule in sugar called fructose, which causes fatty liver disease, insulin resistance, and drives this feed-forward pathway.
So my follow-up question to that would be, you know, that was 1965. I've been out of academia for a while, but I know that the industry-academia connection is stronger today than ever.
Indeed.
You know, with Stanford probably the best model of that, of starting startups and spinning them off, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking here of Theranos. And so the question is, how concerned are you about industry corrupting academic research, with the example of these two Harvard researchers, you know, being sort of a case zero, if you will?
It's funny you should mention that. I am actually writing a plus biology perspective right now on exactly that question. You know, in research, who do you trust? And, you know, why there's concern about corporate research and corporate funding of academic research.
I look forward to it. Renee, if I can just ask two quick last questions. One is, given your specialty in
endocrinology,
biochemicals, what do you think of the Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes hypothesis?
I don't like to call it type 3 diabetes, but there is no question that sugar consumption is correlated with dementia. Now, I use the word correlated. That doesn't mean causative. We don't have the data yet in humans. We have correlated. But in animals, we have causation. And in humans, we have the fact that sugar causes insulin resistance, and insulin resistance is associated with dementia. Now, you can draw a direct arrow, but the science does not allow us to draw that arrow just yet. We are researching it. We're interested in this, obviously, but we can't say that unequivocally today. And I'm about the science.
Excellent questions, Phil. And it, of course, is the ubiquitousness of sugar that makes it so dangerous. It's in places that we little expect it, right?
That's right. Well, sugar's the cheapest thrill that everyone can afford. And that's one of the reasons why it's in everything. It's there very specifically to make you buy more. They put it in on purpose. Now, initially, they put it in because they had to take the fat out of the food, and the food tasted like cardboard. So they had to do something to make the food palatable, so they added sugar because it was, quote, exonerated. And then they realized, hey, people are buying more of this, you know, like the Entenmann's fat-free cakes, which gave my father his heart attack. Mm. You know, the bottom line is they learned from experience that the more they added, the more people bought. And that has been their juggernaut. So prior to the advent of the dietary guidelines in 1977, the annual profit margin for the U.S. food industry was 1% per year. Well, the population was going up at a rate of 1% per year. In other words, they made more money by selling the same amount of food per person to more people. After the dietary guidelines, their profit margin went up to 5% per year. But our population rate actually declined. And the only way they could do that was by selling more food to the same number of people per to make more money.
And you say the federal government agencies are in collusion, that they know better, and yet they permit the food industry to proceed.
Well, number one, 6% of our exports are food, and we get a huge tariff of $56 billion off that. The government gets that. And number two, obviously, the USDA is in charge of helping the American food industry in terms of its business. The problem is they're also in charge of the dietary guidelines. That is the fox in charge of the hen house.
Yikes. All right, let's take another call. Thanks, everybody, for hanging on. Obviously, people are really interested in this, Dr. Lustig. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for this important show. My antidote to stress and depression is exercise.
It's a very good one.
And it seems to me that it falls kind of in between the happiness and the pleasure part of it, because exercise does not make me happy, and it doesn't give me any pleasure, but I like the feeling I get after it.
Well,
and
indeed.
It seems to me that this story of exercise and the good feeling you can get, not just directly after it, but just in your general life, is important and hasn't gotten through. And I'd also like you to touch on the issue of endorphins.
Absolutely. So one of the things we haven't come to yet is the ways to deal with this problem, you know, the personal ways to manage this problem. And in the book, the entire last part of the book is devoted to what I call the four C's, all of which have been clinically proven effective to work to up your serotonin, tamp down your dopamine, tamp down your cortisol, and they're all guaranteed or your money back. But none of them cost anything, so don't get a refund. You won't get a refund. The first is connect. The second is contribute. The third is cope, and that's where we're going. And the fourth is cook. So let's do cope, since you asked that question right now. Cope means three things. Okay, first is sleep, because sleep deprivation makes your cortisol rise like crazy, also contributes to insulin resistance through metabolic pathways, thereby driving more dopamine release. Number two is mindfulness. And right now, multitasking is what everyone is doing. That is the single worst thing that could ever have happened to us. And the reason is because only 2.5% of the population can actually multitask. Everyone else is serial unitasking. And every time you switch from one task to the other, you get a bump of cortisol, making things worse. And then the third one is exercise. And exercise does increase your serotonin, but the thing it really does is by tamping down cortisol, you increase your serotonin receptors. So you get a greater feeling of contentment, not while you're exercising, but because your cortisol was down, your serotonin receptors are up, and so you can glean a much greater increase in contentment. And it has now been shown that exercise is as good as SSRIs at alleviating depression.
So, but for people who are in that holiday vortex, Dr. Lustig, you know, I want to feel better, I'm blue, I'm depressed. The last thing I feel like doing is pulling myself, dragging myself up off the sofa and getting on an exercise bike or taking a walk.
That.
So where is the interception? Where do you grab it to get started, to get to the good feelings?
Right, absolutely. So the way I think everyone needs to get started is to recognize what our food supply has done to us. Now, that's number four, is cook. Now, why do I say that? There are three items in food that matter. Two, too little, and one, too much. Too little, tryptophan. Tryptophan is the precursor to serotonin. Where do you find tryptophan? You find it in eggs, poultry, fish. Now, those are not standard components of processed food on purpose because they go rancid. Number two, omega-3 fatty acids. So where do you find these? That's in wild fish, not farmed fish, and flax and certain other grains. Again, not a big component of processed food. And then the third one, whether it's too much causing the problem, is too much fructose, too much sugar, mm-hmm. which is what processed food is, basically. It's a vehicle, it's a sugar delivery vehicle. You know, the same way, cigarette is an nicotine delivery vehicle. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is processed food makes you unhappy by depleting serotonin, amping up your dopamine, and putting you into this obsessive compulsive high dopamine, low serotonin anxiety state that basically leads to addiction and saps your happiness. Real food does exactly the opposite and has been shown to do so. Problem is, that's not what the industry is peddling because they don't make any money on that.
So if someone's having a hard time just getting motivated and finds that they're really blue, if they can't seem to drag themselves up off the couch to go to the gym, start with the
at
food.
At least drag
instead.
Themselves to the kitchen.
Go to the kitchen and cook.
Make your own meal as opposed to buying it from a fast food restaurant or where you don't know what's in the food.
And will your body respond pretty quickly or will it take days or weeks?
It'll take days.
Mm-hmm.
Probably at least a week based on other studies. I've not done those, but others have. Okay, the bottom line is sitting down to a home-cooked meal with your family and your immediate friends, not your extended family. That's a problem.
But, not your virtual friends.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But your family. Mm-hmm. It gets you all four. It connects because you have the interpersonal connection, the eye-to-eye connection, which is important. Number two, it's contributing. Number three, it's coping because it's mindful. Cooking is mindful because you have to concentrate. And number four, it's cooking. And it's doing all of these things at once. So that is probably the single best thing that people can do for themselves today.
That's a great idea.
The problem is 33% of Americans don't know how to cook. And if you don't know how to cook, you're hostage to the food industry for the rest of your life.
Well, this is the time of year when people probably are going to places and eating things that they normally wouldn't. So your advice is if you're going to the holiday party, if you can steer away from the cookies and the pastries and the treats and the sugar and go to the stuff with the L-tryptophan like turkey.
Like the turkey.
Like the turkey.
Yeah, that would be a good place to start. Everybody says, oh, turkey, puts you to sleep. It's actually the insulin rush from Thanksgiving dinner that puts you to sleep. It's not the turkey.
Gotcha.
Let's make that clear.
All right. Thanks. Good questions. Okay, Steve, let's go to you next. Thanks for holding on. Turn down your radio for us, please.
Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Lustig, you've discussed the effects of excess dopamine, and I'm wondering if you have any advice for the 1 million plus Americans who suffer from Parkinson's.
Absolutely.
Who actually lack dopamine.
That's right. So this is very important. So the reason we know about this dopamine reward issue actually came from the early studies of Parkinson's disease patients. Back in the early 1970s, we discovered that Parkinson's disease was a degeneration of neurons in a different part of the brain, not the reward center, but a different part of the brain called the substantia nigra, which is in charge of your motor movements, your gross motor movements. And the neurotransmitter that it uses, that area, is dopamine. So by giving a precursor to dopamine called L-DOPA, we were able to improve the motor function of patients with Parkinson's disease. And to this day, dopamine agonists are still the standard care of treatment for Parkinson's patients. But what we also found out in the late 1970s when people were starting to do this was that a significant portion of the patients who were treated with L-DOPA became either religious zealots or gamblers or alcoholics.
Wow.
Because their reward system, which is a different area of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, but also uses dopamine, and the L-DOPA didn't distinguish between the two areas of the brain. You were basically giving dopamine to both, and it caused people to experience all of these high dopamine addictive-like states. So, in fact, we have learned that, and so now we temper our L-DOPA or Sinemet dosaging so as not to experience those behavioral effects.
All right. Anthony, San Francisco, thanks for holding on. Your question for Dr. Lustig?
Good morning. It seems like the takeaway message from this to focus on...
I'm going to ask you to turn your radio down, Anthony.
I don't have my radio on.
Okay, we're hearing a little feedback. Sorry to interrupt. Go right ahead.
Is that better?
Much better. Great. Thank you.
Okay. It seems like the basic takeaway is to value happiness and be suspicious of pleasure. And well, that's a message that would be familiar to anyone who has studied Buddhism or Stoic philosophy. Mm-hmm. Or the wisdom traditions in many different religions. I'm curious, have these philosophical and faith traditions informed your work, and vice versa, how can your work inform these other traditions?
Absolutely. So it's a very good question. Mm-hmm. It has informed my work, not because I am a Buddhist. I am not. but by knowing about Buddhism and recognizing that, you know, a lot of the Eastern religions, you know, seek happiness in a very different way than Western religions do, you know, this has been demonstrated. In fact, if you scan the brains of Tibetan monks, and there's a very famous one, the Dalai Lama's English and French interpreter, his name is Matthew Ricard. He is not just a practiced Buddhist monk. He is also a PhD molecular biologist and has submitted himself to numerous PET and fMRI scans and has written his own book, and there have been books written about him. So there's a lot of data on this issue. It shows that what Buddhism does, the mindfulness of Buddhism, tamps down that amygdala and actually reduces dopamine neurotransmission in a, you know, consistent way. And so there are some real reasons for being able to do this. Now, I'm not suggesting people need to be Buddhists. What I am suggesting is that people need to be mindful. And anyone can be mindful, having nothing to do with religion. In fact, religion can boost your serotonin through community, but it can also boost your dopamine through zealotry. And so being careful about your religion is very important. Let's, for example, let's take the Buddhist monks that are currently massacring the Rohingya in Myanmar. Okay, they're Buddhist. Hasn't stopped them, has it? So it's not the religion, it's the community. The community part of religion is what works in terms of the contentment aspect. There are 4,200 religions on the planet. If any of them were the true way forward, there'd only be one.
Well, religion is at the core of the whole Christmas holiday. And
is it?
Well, it started out that way.
Well, it started out that way, and then it got co-opted by industry.
And you think that was deliberate, too?
Oh, obviously. Absolutely.
Okay,
Santa Claus? Okay, a marketing ploy, please.
So
let's be honest.
To bring religion back into the season, is that one of your recipes?
Absolutely.
Do you think?
For the right reasons, not for the wrong ones.
Okay. Let's go to AJ in Palo Alto. Thanks for holding on, AJ. Go right ahead.
Hi. So this has been super fascinating to listen to, but I feel like there's a lot of advice and a lot of thinking for adults to do, and I guess I just wanted your input about kids, because mm-hmm. I know in public schools and a lot of schools across the United States, kids don't really have a choice about what they eat in school, and
right.
what they eat in school is heavily processed foods.
Indeed.
So it's almost like they're being trained to eat these processed foods in school, K-12, and then throughout life.
And don't you think that's on purpose? Why do you think that most of the concessions at public schools are run by fast food companies? Not here in San Francisco, mind you, but around the rest of the country. And we are trying to do something about that. We've actually started a nonprofit to take this on called Eat Real. And REAL is an acronym, Responsible Epicurean and Agricultural Leadership. We certify restaurants, hospital cafeterias, schools. We're we've just put in a grant to embark on doing exactly this in the Mount Diablo School District over in the East Bay very soon, is to get each of the school cafeterias certified to serve real food and to teach the fourth graders to cook.
And you're a pediatric endocrinologist. What have you noticed over time in terms of, if anything, a change in how children and how they're eating is affecting them biologically? Have you seen those kinds of biological changes?
Well, of course. As an obesity physician, kids grow horizontally, not vertically anymore. Mm-hmm. I went into endocrinology to help them grow vertically, and now I basically have to help them not grow horizontally. That's been a major sticking point within the field. But it's not just the food. It's the technology. It's the feed-forward effect of message boards, texting, chat rooms, these are basically methods for upping your dopamine. Facebook, very clearly shown, the longer you use Facebook, the more depressed you become. Now, Facebook will tell you that, yes, there is a correlation between Facebook use and depression, but they would say those people were already depressed. And so they're different. That's not true. We have the time lag analysis data on everyone to show that anyone and everyone who uses Facebook 2 weeks later shows depressive symptoms. This is not good.
And once you start children down this path, is there any way to reverse that path?
Of course there is. But the problem is it's everywhere, just like sugar is. It's ubiquitous. And you can't even get kids away from their cell phones or their computers, because now they have to do their group projects through Facebook in school. The school's mandated it. They give them iPads. My sixth grader has an iPad from school that she has to use. It's a little disturbing. We had blocked Facebook from my older child until 10th grade, But then we had to release it because she was on the Lowell High School debate team, and that's how they communicated with each other for practices and rehearsals.
So you can't pry them away.
No, you can't. So the bottom line is, you know, we've, you know, bought into this notion that all technology is good, and there's a dark side to everything, and we are now experiencing the dark side of the environment we have created.
Well, to end on a high note, with about a minute left, what's your best advice for someone who might be struggling through the holidays to kind of hit the reset button for the new year?
The first thing I would do is clear out your pantry. The second thing I would do is cook a couple of meals for yourself, and try to stay out of the restaurants over the holidays because no good can come from it. And the third thing I would do is enjoy a pleasant walk outside and take in the beautiful view of San Francisco and go walk amongst the Christmas lights and enjoy being uplifted by the spirit.
Love that prescription, Doctor. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco, author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. Thank you all for joining us, for checking out Your Call Radio today. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Tomorrow, it's the Media Roundtable. Your Call is produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email your show ideas to yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Lauren Schechner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman, chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.